Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
So, how do you know when your dog really knows something? That's something that Julie and I have talked about a number of times over the years, and we thought perhaps that's a question you've wondered too. So today on Your Family Dog, we thought we'd dive into that a little bit. So Julie, when your clients ask you, how do I know if my dog really gets it? What do you tell them?
Well, one of the things that I tell them is I said, well, there's a test you can do that I believe Ian Dunbar came up with, where you lay prone on the floor, face down, and you don't move. Your hands and your legs are by your side. How can your legs be by your side? Anyway, your hands are by your side. You're just laying there prone, and you just say, sit. And hope that your dog's bottom hits the ground. And if it does, then you know that your dog understands the word sit means put my bottom on the ground. And the reason why this is a test that Ian does is because you're not using any body language. You're not cueing him with your head or your arms or your eyes or just the general nature of maybe leaning forward a little bit. And so I think then to get your dog to that level of sit, most people don't quite get there. But that's the idea, is that if your dog can just follow the word sit when you're standing behind a door or you're laying prone on the ground, then that's a pretty sure sign that he understands what that actual word means. When I'm working in class sometimes, because this comes up and people will come into class and they're just like, he's so great in the home in the kitchen. He does everything I ask him, and then I bring him here and he doesn't do anything. He won't sit and he won't look at me. And I said, yeah, I get that. You know, but your kitchen is not the same as my classroom. For one, do you have, you know, six other dogs in your class, in your kitchen? Do you have all the scents from the class before? Do you have me standing here with a bait bag full of, you know, hot dogs? No, there's a lot more distraction. And so the idea that your dog can't do something that you think he can do when distracted is a good key that maybe this is not a behavior that's been proved, or to the point where the dog really understands that no matter what's going on around me, I do what I can do. So we sometimes, in order to prove this point, one of the things that I will do is I do a little experiment where you have to get your dog to sit. And we're going to do it three different ways. The first way is you can't say anything and you can't move your arms or your hands. So your hands have to be glued to your side, and you have to get your dog to sit. And then the second way is no words, and you can't move your body. All you can do is move your arms or your hands and see if you can get your dog to sit. And then the third way is you have to be, you know, the steadfast tin soldier and not move your arms and legs, not move your body, and just use the word sit. And what we find is that the dog responds usually in the order to body movement, hand movement, word. Not always, but that tends to be the way. And that tells you what your dog does know about that word sit. So I will do that sometimes. And then I also try to reassure them that making a habit is hard, whether it's, you know, well, bad habits seem to be pretty easy to do, but, you know, good habits,
because they're self-reinforcing.
They are. You know, it's kind of like, you know, counter serving is a bad habit, but boy, it's got a huge payoff.
Huge payoff.
So part of it is I say, let's take a look at what are we trying to do? We're trying to teach our dog a habit. We're trying to teach our dog that whenever they get a particular cue, you have to do something. So when you want to increase that cue, there's lots of different ways that you can do to make it more effective. What do you do when somebody asks you?
I'd actually like to back up a little bit with your three-part test, because I think we might have confused folks there.
Probably.
I got a confused image between part one and part two. So tell me the three different ways that we would test the cue to get the dog to sit.
The first way is that you can move your body, but you can't move your arms or your hands. So they have to be sort of locked to your side. And you can move your body any way
so
you
want.
So I could,
like, bend at the waist. I could nod. Right. I could, tilt my chin.
Correct. Those are any things you can do. You just can't move your arms and legs. You can't say anything. This has to be silent. Mm-hmm. Then the second way is you can't move your body, but you can move your hands and your arms any way you want. Mm-hmm. Okay? And you can't say anything. And then the third way is you cannot move your body, you cannot move your arms, your hands, anything. You can just use the word sit and see what happens. I have another sit test too, but that's the first sit test that we do.
Okay.
And so what we find, and I'm sure you probably have found this too if you've done something similar, is that for most people, dogs really are paying attention to our body language. And most people,
their natural language.
It is.
They communicate exclusively, well, not exclusively, but 99% of dog communication is body language. So they're wired to watch movement,
right,
and position and expression, not to listen to sounds. That's not their, oh, I wonder what my friend Coco is thinking. Oh, I'm listening to how she's barking at me, and that's the only communication. No, look at her whole body. That's what I'm watching.
Right. And what we find generally is with that sit test that if people move, like step towards their dog, or they lean in towards mm-hmm. their dog, or bend at the waist, the dog goes, oh, boom, and goes right into a sit. Because think about the number of times when you've been trying to get your dog to sit, you're generally leaning over, getting close, like, hello, sit. And so your dog learns, you lean towards me and I will sit. And oftentimes just a step towards the dog will elicit a sit. Mm-hmm. So they really are paying attention to your proximity, especially your upper body proximity to them.
I do something very similar. I don't break out the arms versus the body, but I'll do a physical cue only and a verbal cue only. And then we talk about the differences. And I often do the verbal cue only one first, where I give, very strict instructions about the tin soldier pose. And then I say, okay, now what was it that your brain was wishing you could do? Were you wishing you could nod your head? Were you wishing you could move your hand? What was it that you were like, ugh? And half the time, even when they swear to me, they were totally still. I'm like calling them out. I'm like, look, nodding, bending. If we do it as fun, then it's fine that we're setting up the clients for this is a game. We are not getting all
right.
hung up on what does your dog, succeed at or not succeed at, not measuring anyone's success. People are just as, well, not just as sensitive, but almost as sensitive as dogs to body language too. We're very body language focused species as well. So I think it's sort of a misnomer when clients expect that their dogs are going to have awesome verbal skills, but they themselves don't realize how many physical cues they're giving their dog. And so, mm-hmm. You're teaching your dog
right.
to lie down by leaning over and pointing at the floor. And then one night you're sitting at the dinner table and you turn around and just say the word down and the dog doesn't lie down. Well, you didn't lean over and point at the floor, but you didn't realize that.
That's right.
Because in your head, you've been teaching your dog the word as you lean over and point at the floor. But for a dog, you could say peanut butter and they'd be like, look, I'm lying on the floor, or potato chip, or any number of random things, which we do sometimes in class too. Sometimes we'll put ridiculous words with body cues and say, okay, so now if you do this and say peanut butter, will your dog sit? Because that's the cue you use for sit. And if you do something, I call it the Vanna White routine. If you do something really crazy with your arms and then you give a cue like down, will your dog lie down? Well, maybe, but maybe not, because you've done something odd.
Not. Right. Right. And I always preface this with, mm-hmm. this is information gathering. Let's find out what your dog knows. And generally they have a really good time with it. And what I find is that mm-hmm. it's very eye opening and it teaches an awful lot of tolerance for the dog. And the other thing we'll do is I will do what I call the six sits, which don't say that fast. So what we'll do is I will give everyone a chair. And I say, what your dog probably understands sit means is I am in front of my person and I put my bottom on the ground and I look at them and they give me a treat, right? But what we want them to understand is sit does not mean that. Sit means put your bottom on the ground. So I will have them do sit in six different ways. Sit in front of you, sit at your right side, and sit at your left side while you're standing. And you only get to say the word once. That's the other thing. We try not to make it sit, right? It's sit. And if we're having a trouble on one of the sides, then I say, but you can, if you need to, you can use a treat to lure your dog into a sit while you say it just once. And then I have them sit in a chair and have their dog sit in front of them, sit to their right, and sit to their left. Because what that helps the dog to learn is that it doesn't matter my position in relationship to my person, whether he or she is standing or he and she are sitting, whether I'm on their side, if they say that word, I have to put my bottom on the ground. So that's kind of another sit test as well, but it's also a way in which you can encourage your dog to understand that sit mm-hmm. means put my bottom on the ground, no matter where I am in relationship
to my
person.
Yeah, that's when we've used it all about dogs too, because people are so unaware of how much their proximity and positioning in relation to the dog affects the dog's understanding of the behavior. Because for most dogs, I think sit means sit 12 to 15 inches in front of your person, face to face, and in the kitchen. I mean, like, if you were to ask a dog what does sit mean, it means get really close to my person and sit and look at them in the kitchen. So sometimes we're like, oh, so there you are on your walk, stopping at a corner and asking your dog to sit at your side over so you're not face to face outside where stuff is happening. Huh, I have no idea what you're talking about. And it's not disobedience, it's misunderstanding. And so that correct. Helps us to realize, correct. Oh, well, we have some training to do. Awesome. That's information. Right. We can use that.
Right. And I will tell people, I would like you to practice this in every room in the house where your dog is allowed. I no longer say every room in your house because they're like, but hey, I don't let him in the formal dining room. Okay, well then, every room that he can go into, let's practice something in there so we understand it's also not environmental triggers as well. But I also like what you were saying is that even if your dog really does know sit and you could, you know, be halfway, you know, down the block and throw your arm in the air and the dog would go into a sit, that's great. But if your dog doesn't sit, it might just be that it's not just a lack of training for that particular circumstances. It could be that those circumstances are so unnerving to the dog that it's not that I don't want to, I literally can't because it's too difficult and I am anxious or upset. And I try to describe it to people. I say, if you have ever felt anxious, you know, sometimes you will be in an environment and you're feeling kind of anxious and it's basically taking everything that you have, all your resources to hold yourself together. So you look somewhat normal and you don't go completely off the deep end. And then somebody comes up and asks you a question like, what's 4 times 4? And you can't possibly answer because you have no resources left because you're trying to manage your anxiety. And I think sometimes it's like that for dogs. We ask them to do something that we think they can do, but we put them in a situation where they're surrounded by people or you know, maybe there's too many people and are really uncomfortable. So I tell people, I said, use that as a cue too, that if you in normally your dog sits and we don't sit, he's probably not being stubborn. There's probably something else going on and pay attention to that. Doesn't mean you can't do some more training to help him with that. And that, you know, maybe more training will actually help him to be more comfortable because now I do understand what I can do.
And understand whether or not these other things are scary or need to be scary to me. You know, so if your dog is distracted by, say, traffic, I was working with a puppy this week. He's 6 months old and his brain falls out when a bus goes by. So he's walking, he's brilliant. And then there's a bus and he's standing and looking at a bus. And then the bus goes by and he's walking and he's brilliant. And then cars are going by, vans, life is good. And then a bus goes by and he's not being bad or reactive, but he's just totally focused on the bus. Like, his brain is on the bus too. And so I don't think this is going to be a lifelong problem for this dog. He can handle the cars going by. So as we work on this piece and say, like, buses are safe too, you don't need to be concerned about that. They will have that responsiveness from him as he gets a little bit older. So training in this perspective of, if your dog can't do it when there's too many people around or whatever, the idea isn't keep working on making the dog do it, but keep working to make the dog happy, safe, and comfortable. And when we're happy, safe, and comfortable, we can perform better, whatever the skill.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why, with my beginning classes, I always have, when everybody comes in, I build, because I learned this at All About Dogs, we call them condos. But I have these folding screens, and I put, and everybody the first week of class has a condo. Because sometimes I, especially in my beginning class, if I get a lot of young dogs, it's like, I can't handle it. That little Dalmatian over there is so cute. I have to go say hi to her. And no, you don't. But you can step behind the divider when you can't see the little Dalmatian. And now maybe we can sit. And I tell my owners, you can go in and out of your condo as you see fit. But if you feel like your dog needs a break because we're starting to lose focus or we're starting to just lose it, step behind your condo. And what I have found is that usually by about the third week or so, most of the condos are gone. There are some dogs that always have to have a condo, but usually all the condos are gone. And by the sixth week or the last week of class, everybody is sitting there very nicely out in the open. But it's providing dogs with the opportunity to regroup and to gather themselves together, I think, is really important. And I will use that sometimes when we're working out. Like, you were talking about the little guy with the bus. And it reminds me of a golden retriever that I had been working with. And it was something similar. I don't remember what it was, but it was something like a certain kind of car or bus or truck or something. She would just like, oh, look. So one of the things we found was that if her owner stepped, that's one thing nice about, like, buses and trucks is they're pretty big and you can see them, right? So what she would do is, she saw something coming, she would step off the path, off the sidewalk or the path, about 10 feet, get her dog to turn and focus on her, and feed her a lot of treats while the bus or the truck, whatever it was, went by. And pretty soon she was able to, what the dog learned was, big truck, look at mom. Mm-hmm. Good stuff happens. And so they were able to shorten the distance she had to go off the path. And to the point where, you know, she would see a truck coming, she'd just give her a few treats, she'd focus on her, the truck would go by. So the same kind of thing you were talking about with the puppy, is just a recognition that this is something that we will work through. This is not something that we necessarily have to be concerned about, but there are ways to overcome this kind of distraction, anxiety. But the same kind of thing happens, but I think it's also great to recognize it as a cue that if I'm asking my dog to do something and they can't because there's the presence of something else, we need to pay attention to that and provide distance and distraction so that you can do what I would like you to do.
And I also think just recognizing that there are times that we can successfully do things and times we can successfully not. you know, so it's one of those things. I've had an incredibly busy week, and I can feel that there is less brain space for me to handle stuff that pops up. I can just feel that. That's normal. That happens to everyone. We're aware of it. I mean, the depletion research shows that when too much is going on, we don't perform as well. And the same is true for our dogs. So even if your dog absolutely knows a cue, and even if your dog is always comfortable in the living room, and even if your dog is, you know, super at doing rollover, and you've been away for 5 days and you were busy doing stuff and the dog was in a different environment for those 5 days, and you come home and you're in your living room and it's a safe, happy, comfortable place, and you say rollover and the dog doesn't do it, some of that can be after effects. Some of it can be, I'm just not quite all back in my head yet. And so I think it's great to have sort of tests that that tell us where a level of training and understanding is, like we were talking about at the beginning. You know, I personally don't know too many people who have done the Ian Dunbar sit test for all of their cues, like lying on the floor and giving the cue. Most actual professional dog trainers never even bother to that level. And very few clients, I'm sure. And then we're talking about that for every cue, like sit and down and roll over and spin and everything your dog knows to that level. But just recognizing that that's an option tells us that there are ranges of behavior and that we are comfortable with ranges of behavior. And then we need to decide what good enough looks like for my house. And
absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that that's people. You must have really well behaved dogs. I was like, you know, you're so kind. No, my dogs are good enough. You know, they're good enough for what I need them to do. So I think that that's really important. One of the things I was also going to say too, you mentioned a little bit about, we were talking about fatigue, that you had so much stuff going on, that I was reading, I'm doing a new program, eating program. And one of the things they talked about is decision fatigue. And the average person makes 221 food decisions every single day. And so you can understand why in the morning when we're fresh and we haven't made all these decisions, it's much easier to make healthy choices for food. But as the day goes on, the decision fatigue sets in. And that's why most people fall off their diets or make bad food decisions later in the day. And if you think about it, it's probably the same thing for our dogs, which is why I tell people, you know, I don't know anyone, including myself, who can really carve out an hour a day to train my dog. You know, but on the other hand, if you can do 3 to 5 minutes, 3 to 5 times a day with your dog, then you're going to get some practice in, but you're also not going to hit decision fatigue for your dog. And you're also not going to get to the point where it's probably too boring. So, you know, pick 2 or 3 things, try them 3 or 4 times, you know, treat. And if they perform perfectly the first time, boom, we're done with that trial, reward that and move along. So that I think one of the better ways in which to help your dog understand what's expected of them is to do these little bitty training sessions, different places in the house, for just a short period of time and end on a successful note.
And then that gives your dog some fluency and skills and really increases the odds that you're going to have communication and reliability in a variety of situations, which is the goal. That's the goal.
Which is the goal. That is absolutely. And the other thing is that it makes it more fun, I think, for you too. Who in the heck wants to go over sit, you know, for half an hour? That's just
not I.
That's exhausting. Not I. And I'm a trainer. So, all right. So to sum up, I think we need to understand that sometimes our dogs are not nearly as fluent in activities as we think they may be. There's come clever little ways you can use to assess exactly how fluid they are in those activities. And that just is more information gathering. The other thing to remember is that when you move into an area of high distraction, lower your expectations on your dog's ability to perform that behavior. You need to build it back up. If you can sit perfectly in the kitchen, doesn't mean you're going to sit perfectly in the driveway. So lower your expectations and move, add your distractions in slowly. And if you're in an environment where you know the dog is normally doing something but can't, maybe you need to take a step back and ask yourself what's going on in the environment that's difficult for my dog.
That about sums it up.
All right. Well, thanks, Colleen. That was a great episode. And we'll see you all next time on Your Family Dog.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.